DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet.
Hello, I'm Irene Quayle. Good to have you with us for this edition of Living Planet.
Wir haben es satt für die Dinge, die wir nicht mehr wollen. Artgerechte Haltung, das fordern wir. Tierleid im Stall.
Wir haben es satt.
Why German farmers and consumers have taken to the streets calling for a revolution in the way we grow our food. Venezuela is having its own farming revolution.
Nosotros somos especialistas en hortalizas.
We are specialized in growing vegetables. Tomatoes, bell peppers, chilies, eggplant, pumpkin, cucumbers, radishes, rutabaga, beetroots, carrots, mangolds, lettuce, and even beans.
And all that in your back garden or even on the windowsill. These and more revolutionary growing stories coming up on Living Planet.
Well, you know, we don't love to see the plan.
Thousands of people took to the streets in Berlin last weekend to protest against industrial agriculture. They're in favour of supporting small farmers, wholesome food, less animal suffering, and against the corporate concentration in the food industry. The movement gives voice to many around the world with similar concerns. Shane McMillan reports.
I can hear the We Are Fed Up demonstration several blocks before I can see it. And when I do arrive beneath the towering office buildings at Berlin's Potsdamer Platz, the scene is something like Rio's Carnival, but with an agricultural theme. Thousands of people are chanting and waving signs. This crowd has come from all over Germany to show their support for small-scale farming. Some have even driven their tractors to get here. And event organizer Iris Kiefer says the furthest tractor came almost 600 kilometers.
Some of them were traveling for about 24 hours, all this long trip together to Berlin.
These 130 tractors represent a resistant core of small producers who've held out against some pretty big changes in Europe's agricultural industry. A century ago, nearly three-quarters of Germans were working in farming. The organizers of this annual rally say that in the last decade, almost 100,000 small producers have been forced to close. They place the blame on agricultural policies that have prioritized cheap food. Back on Potsdamer Platz, the tractors fire up their motors, and together with the other protesters, they file out of the square and down the demonstration route towards Berlin's famous Brandenburg Gate.
I'm a dairy farmer myself. I have 60 cows, and I see how much of my neighbors have to close their farms, and bigger farms are taking the land from these little farms, and they are growing and growing, and the others are disappearing.
Hotmar's neighbors aren't alone in shutting down their operations. According to numbers by the Alternative Farmers Association, nearly 4,000 dairy farmers went out of business in Germany last year alone. Farmers and experts agree that the problem lies with discount pricing, which has pushed the cost of milk so low that it can't sustain the producers anymore. This difference between the price and the value of food is what really unifies the protesters and the farmers at this rally.
They are looking for other possibilities to make a good farming, which is good for the environment, good for the animals, and good for the people.
Not far from his tractor, I meet Stephanie Roth, who's standing behind this long row of tables, sort of at the edge of the demonstration.
So this is a stand where volunteers are collecting postcards that citizens from all around Europe will send to their members of the European Parliament. The members of the European Parliament will vote on the free trade agreement between Canada and Europe, CETA, on the 14th of February. And we think it's really really important to send personal messages to our elected deputies to tell them that we don't want this free trade agreement.
Stephanie says that opening up its markets to foodstuffs produced more cheaply in North America would put German farmers out of business. It would also bring genetically modified food to Europe, which recent studies show as many as 80% of Germans are opposed to.
There's a German saying that is very well known. Every child knows it. It says, du bist, was du isst. You are what you eat.
All around us, scattered between the tractors, the stands, and the huge stage, people are dancing and eating and enjoying themselves, in spite of the cold.
I think only if we go together, hand in hand, consumer and farmer, we can change our system of food production. We want to change the agricultural policy in Germany and in Europe to have a fairer and greener agricultural policy.
Later, I catch up with Karen Hansen-Kuhn. Karen is visiting from Washington, D.C., where she works for the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy. She also says that movements like this one are making an impact.
It's been really interesting to me in discussions about the trade agreements. No matter who I talk to in governments in Europe, when we would bring up the possibility of TTIP, the transatlantic trade deal, they would all tick off, okay, no GMOs, no hormone beef, no clones, no chlorine chicken. And you wouldn't find the same thing in the U.S. if you talk to a policymaker, that they would be able to tick off consistently the same four sets of demands that they're hearing from local populations. And then this year, especially with things being so dire politically in the United States, it was especially nice to be here and to see all of the energy.
Event organizer Iris says, for the moment, despite some trade deals that they're a bit worried about and still shrinking numbers of small farmers in Germany,
yes, there are these big industries and corporations that have a big influence on our agriculture, but this can't be the way of a sustainable agriculture for our future.
Comparing their work to climbing, I ask Iris if she feels like they'll ever get to the top of this mountain.
I like climbing.
Die Dinge, die gut sind, und wir haben es satt für die Dinge, die wir nicht mehr wollen. Artgerechte Haltung, das fordern wir. Tierleid im Stall,
wir haben es satt.
Wasser und Klima schonen, das fordern wir.
Shane McMillan joined the protesters in Berlin who are fed up with industrial farming. People in Venezuela have less choice when it comes to the food they eat. The country is in the grip of a dire economic crisis and a lot of people are starving. Early last year, the government set up a Ministry of Urban Agriculture and appealed to people to grow their own produce and plant in every available space. But not everyone has enough land to grow food, and growing tomatoes on the windowsill can hardly keep people from starving. German correspondent Anne-Katrin Mellmann checked out Venezuela's urban farming revolution in the capital, Caracas. Charlotte Lomas presents her report.
Downtown Caracas, framed by high-rise buildings, subway tunnels, and busy streets, is a vegetable oasis. Herbs, cucumbers, and tomatoes grow in a fenced garden the size of a soccer field. Some pedestrians stop and look in, amazed at the plethora of vegetables. It is a rare sight in a time of extreme shortage. Behind the fence, Manuel Velasquez, a university mathematics professor, bustles among the vegetable beds. Wearing a green jumpsuit, the short man never seems to stand still. He pulls out weeds and proudly points towards his plants as he speaks.
Nosotros somos especialistas en hortalizas.
We are specialized in growing vegetables, tomatoes, bell peppers, chilies, eggplant, pumpkin, cucumbers, radishes, rutabaga, beetroots, carrots, mangoes, lettuce, and even beans.
For 4 years now, Velasquez has been coming to the garden for a few hours every day. The late Venezuelan president, Hugo Chavez, who died in 2013, gave the former park to his people for them to cultivate.
El comandante Chávez vio un modelo.
Our commander Chavez was already enthusiastic about this model 13 years ago. Actually, he was far ahead of the times. This garden here is the first city garden in our country and the only one that was personally inaugurated by Chavez in 2003.
But since Chavez's death, everything has changed. Balescas looks grimly across the street at a tall office building. It houses the new Ministry for Urban Agriculture, founded by Chavez's successor. In Venezuela, hardly anything is produced. For many farmers, it's just not worth the trouble. Neither seeds nor fertilizers are easily available. The ministry has promised to promote city gardens, flower beds on roofs and balconies, tomatoes grown on windowsills. But Balescas and his fellow campaigners have never found an official who has offered them support.
We have to deal with the state because we are revolutionaries. But there is no exchange with the Ministry for Urban Agriculture. They have a different logic. They go from one conference to another. We work on the ground and produce food.
They then sell the food for a low price to the needy population directly from the garden gate. On the other side of the street in the ministry, a group of 50 people watch a video. They are learning to work the soil and sow the seeds. Angela has flown in from her rural region, especially to take the course.
Generalmente cada quien tiene su pedacito de tierra, su huerta detrás de la casa, delante de la casa.
Where I live, almost everyone has a piece of land, a small garden where they can grow the most important things. I want to learn how to get more out of it, though, because it's becoming more difficult for us to get food, because there's a food war. There are also transport problems. We're losing weight, although we eat three times a day. We lack calorie-rich food.
Angela is a government supporter and believes the official line that businesses are waging an economic war against the country and are responsible for the shortages. In his city garden, Manuel Balescas sees it as more of a political problem.
There is far too much sitting around in offices while there's a lot of work to be done in Venezuela. The entire population should be producing. It's about much more than opposition versus government politics. In the media, it's always just about the fight between the two sides and the loud announcements from the government, but nothing concrete. Concrete would be if I said, here's the seed with which I am building something. That's a basic problem today. Too many theories and too little action.
The gardening mathematics professor is full of admiration for the late commander Hugo Chavez. He took action, and Chavez surely would have liked the parting image of Balascas, a 10-kilo cucumber in his arm, presented as a parting gift.
Charlotte Lomas with that report, filed from Venezuela by Anne-Catherine Melman. The West Cape in South Africa is well known for its citrus fruits and fine wines, but here too food prices have been rocketing and change is in the air. The region is suffering from the worst drought in a decade. Experts have warned Cape Town residents that the city has less than 100 days of water supply left. And as Glynis Crook reports, there's a real concern that the city may run out of water if the winter rains don't come on time.
It's another day of temperatures in the 30s here in Cape Town, with a southeasterly wind blowing hard across the peninsula. The air feels as dry as the city's mountain vegetation and gardens look. People are worried about water.
Water is life. Don't let our future dry up. It's up to each one of us to take action now.
But despite constant public reminders to save water, like this one from local radio station Smile, Capetonians are simply failing to comply. Restrictions which came into effect in November require everyone to reduce water usage by 30%. This week, authorities said dams had dropped to below 40% capacity, down from over 55 in November.
No,
At the University of Cape Town, urban water specialist Dr. Kevin Winter says it will be very serious if the rains don't come by the end of March.
We will have to start looking to other contingency plans. It's highly possible that we will start pumping water from the ground and have to distribute it, and it may have to be distributed via trucks to various centres around the city. That's how it's been happening in other parts of the country that have experienced similar drought conditions over the last 2 or 3 years, and maybe this is Cape Town's turn. We're going to have to do something very similar.
In addition, February is traditionally the hottest month of the year. The heat, together with strong winds, means increased evaporation from dams, further reducing water supply. And Winter says it's not certain the rain will come on cue.
The pattern that we've seen in 2015 and in 2016 suggests substantial or significant rain won't come in March. It's most likely to come a whole lot later. There might be an event or two of reasonable rainfall, a day or two, but those days or two, the interval between those rainfall events is longer, more drawn out, and they often are insignificant in terms of really filling up our storage capacity.
Most of us take access to running water for granted. A recent day without it, following a burst pipe in my neighbourhood, made me realise just how often I turn on my taps. But what's even more worrying is that if the city does run dry, not having water will be far from our only problem. The region produces big agricultural commodities, such as grapes, a variety of deciduous fruit like apples and peaches, wheat, canola, and livestock. Several years of insufficient rain have resulted in food prices increasing way above the official inflation rate. And this is likely to get worse, says Carl Opperman, the CEO of the farmers' organisation AgriWestern Cape, as the drought is in its second year.
That is the reason why our dams are so low. That is also the reason that our boreholes is also suffering at this point in time, and that water is basically one of the most scarce commodities. On the very short term, you've got to minimize your losses. You've got to see what you can save. And if we're going to take one step further, is to say, what is your next production processes to take it further? Because you must remember, the agriculture in South Africa is the foundation of our economy. So the crisis on hand is not a farming crisis alone. It's a crisis for the value chain and the population of South Africa.
Cape Town Chamber of Commerce and Industry Executive Director Sid Paymer agrees that the cumulative effect of the drought is starting to have an impact.
Very difficult to measure the exact effect on the economy, but I think as a consumer you can see what it's done to prices. And in some cases prices have doubled of foodstuffs, and the consumers are feeling it. I think we are facing potential extreme restrictions on water use, which will then have a knock-on effect on tourism, on everything that we do, because everything we do is related to water.
Relaxing in the cool water, perfect for a hot summer's day. But swimming pools can only be topped up manually if they're fitted with a cover. One of the many restrictions in place, on top of higher tariffs and fines for failing to reduce consumption. Yet they are not having an impact. Residents are still using close to 100 million litres more per day than the city's target.
I don't really know the exact details about the water restrictions.
I don't know about the water station.
You can't fill up your swimming pool unless you have a cover. You can't water your lawn. I'm not sure. That's all I know about, actually.
I don't have an idea.
We have to be careful how you use water.
I don't have an idea.
Sorry, I don't have any information.
Officials are hoping increased restrictions, which, if approved, will come into effect in February, together with better policing, will have an effect. Xanthia Limburg, the city's political head of utilities, which includes water.
We are in the process of identifying our top 20,000 highest consumers, and we will be targeting those individuals through door-to-door visits, issuing of additional fines, as well as enhancing our education and awareness sessions, and we'll be using our local councillors to assist us in doing so. What the city will also ensure to do is that we intensify issuing of fines. So our law enforcement and our peace officers will be going out from next week, issuing more fines as well as notices to appear in court where there are transgressions.
To make matters worse, a spate of extensive runaway vegetation fires has put extra pressure on water resources. Firemen are using helicopters to bomb seawater onto the flames in higher or more inaccessible areas. But when homes and farmland have been in danger, fire engines are also using potable water.
My 20 years that I've been in this position working in this area is the first time that I've seen that the normal habitat is basically so dry that we've got big trees that are busy dying. So that means that our groundwater is also not there. But what is worse on this whole thing is with all this dry matter lying down there, any spark that you get starts a fire. So yes, a lot of that water that we were so cherishing is that we had to make a decision. We've moved it to firefighting so that we can stop this fire.
As the farmers pray for rain, some Capetonians are rushing out to buy bottles of water before their price soars. Glynis Crook, DW, Cape Town.
When voters go to the polls in the Indian state of Goa next week, one of the key election issues is the coconut. The tasty fruit plays an important role in the economy of the state. It's a defining ingredient of the local cuisine, a thirst quencher, and the tall palms are also a popular tourist attraction, lining sunny Indian beaches. But huge numbers of coconuts have been cut down in the last year since the government classified the palms as just plants rather than trees. This made it legal to cut palms down. For over a year, a battle has been raging between the authorities and activists. The status of the coconut has become a campaign issue, with an opposition party vowing to restore it to the status of a tree if it wins the election. Chavi Sashdev has the background from Goa.
Coconut tree is no more a tree. Goa government has made a history.
In Goa, there's a strange controversy afoot. It hinges on the definition of a tree. Specifically, whether a coconut palm should be classified as a tree or a grass. It's become a thorny issue that's got politicians, land developers, activists, artists, and citizens all riled up. Why? Because back in December 2015, the government of the state of Goa removed the coconut from its official list of trees. Local activists see this as a political move that allows builders to clear land without permission. Now, two conservation groups have sued the state to reverse that decision and reinstate the coconut as a tree.
Well, next door in Goa, people have been rather concerned about a new rule that allows the cutting down of coconut trees without any official permission being required. But what is really worrying people is that the government seems to be trusting builders to make sure that more trees than necessary are not cut down.
Mr. Arlekar also stated that his government had done the amendment towards coconut only to help Goan farmers in the state.
More than 60 coconut trees.
To understand why it's in court, we first have to rewind to 1984, when Goa passed a law, the Goa Preservation of Trees Act, to imprison anyone who cut down trees over an area of 2 hectares, which is 2% of a square kilometer, in 1 year. Akash Urbello is a lawyer representing the NGOs Vanashakti and Goa Forgiving in court. He says that under the law, you need permission from the state forest department to fell any local tree from the list, even if it's in your own private garden. Otherwise, you face a prison sentence of 3 months and a fine between 100 and 1,000 euros. The only exception is if a tree poses a threat to life or a person's property. So, if a coconut is a grass or a plant or a shrub, that is, if a coconut is not a tree, then there are no restrictions on cutting it down.
So the definition leads to the consequence of that, which is whether you can cut it down or not indiscriminately. If something is a tree, it's protected under the Act. And you need permission of the tree authority, that's slightly difficult, and it's capped at 2 hectares.
Environmental activist Prajal Sakhadande is one of the group taking the government to court. He says the coconut tree is crucial for the environment.
Two things play a very important role to keep the sand from getting eroded. One is the coconut tree, and the other one is the sand dune vegetation. So that is why our ancestors planted. The coconut tree. If you see most of the beaches in the south especially, you'll find a line of coconut trees. So ecologically very significant, environmentally very important. Now people are cutting it for construction purposes and all, that's a very sad thing.
The government disagrees. The state's environment minister, Rajendra Arlekar, said the law is about helping farmers to enable them to get rid of dead wood.
Those who are already in this business, they have been advising this for years together. And that is the reason why we have come with the amendment.
The environment minister went on to say that these farmers are keen to replace coconut trees with higher yield palms. But locals here in Goa dismiss this claim. They insist it's part of the state government's plan to clear the way for construction projects. Who benefits, they ask. Lawyer Ribello has this answer.
Anyone who wants to fell more than 2 hectares of trees. And that generally tends not to be ordinary people. You know, the dots aren't difficult to connect. They're very populous trees in a state that wants to develop and, you know, development projects.
On two-wheel scooters, Kapil Korgaonkar from the Goa Heritage Action Group and I make our way down a bumpy, narrow dirt path in Shirley, a village in North Goa. When we arrive, we see earth-moving equipment, building debris, gravel, and wide tire prints in the soft mud. Up until the previous week, this area had been a coconut grove. Locals tell us 150 trees disappeared at night.
This is completely illegal. Because of this politicians, people are scared of politicians, so no one is coming forward, you know, to heckle this situation.
That's Kapil Korgaonkar, who has been trying to get locals to complain to the authorities. I reached out to several big builders in Goa. Only one would speak to me, and he insisted that, on the contrary, he plants many more trees than he cuts down. Korgaonkar tells me that the builder lobby is very strong in Goa and that farmers are hurting. The coconut is the backbone of the local economy. A family with a few coconut trees has enough for cooking and to sell. Each part of the tree, from frond to fruit to trunk, is used. If you have some coconut trees, chickens and goats, you don't even need a job. Armando Gonzalez from the NGO Goa for Giving, the third plaintiff in the case against the state, is encouraging people to report when they see trees being cut. The NGO is building a dossier to keep track of fellings, but it's difficult because their network is so scattered. To raise awareness, they've organized demonstrations and even coconut festivals in the cities. With his NGO, he's strategizing new ways to engage the community.
I think the government is clearly trying to play games with all of us. They are trying to say it's for the farmers and the benefit of the farmers. It's not. A real farmer would never cut a coconut tree. No Goan would do that unless you're a builder. So for a builder, it's blanket permission. Do what you want. Pick up the land and cut it.
At the grassroots level, activists fear that villagers won't be able to stop powerful lobbies from cutting their trees. In the Goa for Giving office, Gonzalez is talking to Michael Gracious, a writer and theatre artist in the local Konkani language. Gracious is using folk theatre to tell villagers about the amendment and how it will impact their livelihoods.
There is a word in Konkani we use called Goinkarpon. Goinkarpon is Goanness. It is incomplete without a coconut tree.
He developed a musical theatre production about the coconut's changed definition and new non-tree status, travelling with makeshift tents across 50 villages. He's confident that these people can influence the government through their vote.
They'll definitely come out to compel their elected representative to raise up the issue, to see that the act is changed.
But elected representatives move slowly. That's why environmental activists Sakar Dande, Goa for Giving, and Vanashakti, which means forest power, sued the Goa government. That lawsuit is still in court. Their lawyer Ribello explains.
So the litigation is essentially to drop its absurd stance that it's not a tree.
Though the Goa High Court seems to think that the environmentalists have a reasonable case, the state has stalled them by asking for several extensions and multiple postponements. For now, the status quo continues. The coconut tree is still not a tree. And it's back to demonstrations, songs and petitions as groves of coconuts continue to disappear. Goa, save coconut trees. Goa. For DW, Chavi Sachdev in Goa, India. Goa, Goa, save your searing beauty.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Living Planet. You can listen to the programme again or to individual stories online at dw.com/environment or on iTunes or SoundCloud. I'm Irene Quayle. Producing with me in the studio were Ileana Ghiaducci and Max Timmer. Until next time, thanks for listening and bye for now. Regina and Pascal, a corona, kai changes, going to look.